The 2nd of May is not too soon to hear about this summer's big movies. And in a moment, we'll hear about one of the first big action movies of this coming summer. But first, for equal time, remember a few years ago when the hit movie Chocolat hit movie screens. That's chocolate for those of you who are, those of us who are language impaired. It was the ultimate chick flick. Juliette Binoche, Johnny Depp, lots of chocolate. Now the author of the book that inspired the movie has written a sequel. And Martha Woodruff reports from member station WMRA.
In The Girl with No Shadow, Joanne Harris revisits the world she created in Chocolat, one where ordinary-seeming people don't quite live ordinary lives, which certainly describes the author's childhood.
I had a great-grandmother who believed in so many strange superstitions that I was infused with these beliefs from an early age. She used to tell the future from the things that catch on to the hem of your skirt when you've been sewing, and different coloured threads would mean different things. And if a black cat crossed your path, it could be bad luck coming from one side or good luck coming from another, and certain flowers were bad luck and certain signs were good luck. And of course, all that influenced me quite a lot as a child.
Is that child still alive in you?
Totally, yeah. She's writing the books now.
Joanne Harris's 1996 novel Chocolat introduced us to Vianne Rocher, maker of magical sweets, on the page as winsome and winning as Juliette Binoche was in the 2000 film adaptation.
The pepper triangle, that's for you.
Tiny hint of chili pepper to play against the sweetness. Tangy, adventurous.
I hadn't realized at the time of writing Chocolat how much history and folklore has been attached to it.
Joanne Harris says the appeal of chocolate is that we all know it's both delicious and somehow wrong.
We've always had this kind of built-in idea that confectionery and witchcraft are somehow linked. The idea that from the witch in the gingerbread house, of which the tiles were made of chocolate, to the Snow Queen and her enviable capacity to conjure up Turkish delight out of thin air, there's always been this kind of link between witches and confectionery.
In The Girl with No Shadow, 5 years have passed since Vianne Rocher closed the door of her shop in a picture postcard French village. Mother now of two daughters, Vianne is attempting to live a quiet, non-magical, dutifully maternal life in Montmartre. And this life is just not working.
If Chocolat is milk chocolate, The Girl with No Shadow is dark chocolate.
Joanne Harris describes this chapter of Vianne Rocher's life as a dark urban fairy tale.
Chocolat was very much about what makes you happy, whereas The Girl with No Shadow is what makes you afraid. And Zosie, who is, I have to say, my favourite villain so far, has got the edgy attraction that you get from what frightens you and what's dangerous.
In this passage from the novel, as Vianne's older daughter first catches sight of Zosie, she mistakenly sees in her all the magical light and playfulness that her mother once had.
From the back, at first I thought I knew her. The bright red coat that matched her shoes. Coffee cream hair tied back with a scarf. And were there bells on her print dress? And a jingling charm bracelet around her wrist? And what was that? That faintest gleam in the wake of her, like something in a heat haze.
Joanne Harris says she took up Vianne Rocher's story again because it just didn't feel finished after Chocolat.
There might be a third book, who knows? I don't think that this is necessarily the last chapter in her story.
But the author hastens to add that she, like the rest of us, we'll just have to wait and see if Vianne Rocher and her magical desserts will reappear yet again to tempt the appetites of readers. For NPR News, I'm Martha Woodruff.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. It is not easy to take care of soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and even after recent scandals, it's not clear if the U.S. Army is getting it right. Yesterday, we told you about an alarming number of soldiers who have overdosed on potent prescription drugs they were given by Army doctors. Today, we're going to hear about one Army hospital in Texas that is trying to improve the care it gives soldiers. But it's hard to get everything right for patients with post-traumatic stress disorder and head injuries. NPR's Joe Shapiro reports.
If you want to see what's changed at Army hospitals, just spend some time with Sergeant Scott Metcalf of the Minnesota National Guard. Metcalf was a gunner injured in a Humvee accident in Iraq. He was about to be sent to Walter Reed, but because of the problems at that hospital in Washington, he got sent instead to Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio. Now he's waiting for the Army to discharge him. He's been here for 14 months.
This is home. This is my room.
Metcalf shows his small room with a single bed in the outpatient barracks. He was a prison guard back in Minnesota. After 9/11, he signed up for the Army National Guard. He's 49 now. Sometimes he finds himself giving out fatherly advice to the younger soldiers here. He's got two sons of his own back home. Another, a Marine, just got back from his third tour in Iraq. That's why Metcalf keeps a large Marine Corps insignia over his bed.
So that's just kind of my little reminder for him each day.
In the 14 months Metcalf has lived here, the Army has changed the way it cares for injured soldiers. Almost a year ago, the Army opened new warrior transition units at 35 hospitals, with more staff devoted to helping soldiers. Now there's one squad leader, a nurse case manager, and a doctor assigned to every injured soldier. You get a sense of what's changed just by looking at the calendar spread across Scott Metcalf's wall. It lists his appointments and tells him when to renew his medications.
Yeah, it's very simple. I mean, I guess I'm the old KISS factor, keep it simple, stupid. Or else, like I say, keep it simple, Scotty, you know.
This reminder system helps Scott Metcalf compensate for the memory he's lost because of a head injury. On this day, his wife is visiting. Kathy Metcalf has taken another of many unpaid leaves from her job as a nurse back in Minnesota to spend several days with her husband. She says when he first came to this Texas hospital, she'd call him at least once every day just to remind him of things.
His short-term memory is not as good as it used to be. I mean, initially, then I would call every day so he didn't miss his appointments and didn't forget.
Now he gets lots of reminders from the extra caseworkers that have been hired here. He writes them all on his calendar. Another thing that's changed since he's been here, now each injured soldier is assigned one doctor who coordinates all their care, especially prescriptions.
You might see 10 different doctors with all your different care, and at one point, 10 different doctors were giving you medications. And I've seen guys before, a few months ago, I mean, I've seen guys that had tons of bags full of medicines that either they were taking or they didn't know what they were, and now they're down to the drugs they actually need.
Still, there have been numerous prescription drug overdoses in these new warrior transition units. Since last June, at least six soldiers have died from an interaction of the drugs they'd been given by Army doctors. One of those deaths was here at Brooke. In January, Sergeant Robert Nichols died from an accidental drug intoxication. He was on 11 different medications, including powerful painkillers and sleeping pills. In some cases, soldiers overdosed when they mixed drugs with drinking. So in March, the Army banned alcohol in outpatient barracks and ordered some soldiers, depending on their risk, not even to drink off post. Still, there have continued to be drug overdoses. Brigadier General James Gilman runs medical operations here.
The mission of the Warrior Transition Unit is to help soldiers heal. And giving them a directive not to drink at all is one of the steps that's been taken to try to cut down on these deaths and also to help soldiers heal quicker.
Gilman points to other changes. There are new buildings going up, and services for injured soldiers that a year ago were spread in multiple locations across San Antonio, they're now all available on one floor of the hospital. There are 600 injured soldiers here. A year ago, Gilman says he had a staff of about 30 for them. Now he's got 200. Still, a recent report from the Government Accountability Office noted shortages of staff trained to care for PTSD and traumatic brain injuries. It's a problem because another recent study by the independent RAND Corporation found about one-third of soldiers come back from Iraq with PTSD, a head injury, or both. General Gilman.
First of all, I don't think we've ever had I know we've never had, in my 30 years in the Army, this much demand for behavioral health services. And secondly, I think there is a bit of a shortage in the country of at least psychiatrists and psychologists.
There's another problem that came out of the scandal at Walter Reed, and it's been harder to change. The slow and confusing way the Army determines disability benefits and lifetime access to health care. Scott Metcalf came here to get treatment for his neck, shoulder, and brain injuries. But his wife Kathy puts her hand softly on his shoulder and says there was one injury that took her husband a long time to admit, his PTSD.
I'm proud of my husband for taking that step because it was hard. And he has to work on it every day.
I want soldiers to know, too, is that it doesn't make you any less of a soldier, no matter who you are, from a private to a sergeant major or from a lieutenant to a colonel or whatever. PTSD is, it's an illness or disease or whatever you want to call it, but what you need to do is accept it and don't be afraid of the stigma, because it is a problem and you can deal with it, and there are people out there to help you with it.
Now Metcalf sees psychiatrists, and he's on several medications to ease his anger, his nightmares, and inability to sleep. He never thought he'd be here for 14 months. He says he can finish his treatment back home in Minnesota, but it's taken months for the Army to determine his level of disability so he can be discharged. Although his Army doctors and Army psychiatrists say he has severe PTSD, the Army officially says he doesn't. Its rating board says he has a less serious mental health problem and anxiety disorder.
What I need people to realize is that the Army needs to take responsibility for PTSD. I do have PTSD, but the Army's putting me out with anxiety disorder, and it gives the Army an excuse that, you know, we don't have a problem with PTSD.
Veterans advocacy groups suspect the Army tries to save money by giving soldiers disability ratings for less serious conditions than, say, PTSD. The Army says that's not so. Overall, it says disability ratings have been higher in the last year, and that costs the Army money. Indeed, Metcalf appealed his rating and got a new one, high enough so he'll always get Army health care, even though the board still says he doesn't have PTSD. So Metcalf has decided to quit challenging the Army. He's waiting for a discharge date so he can go home to Minnesota. Because of his physical disabilities, he can't do his old job as a prison guard. Scott Metcalf says he'd like to go back to school and maybe become an elementary school teacher. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
This is the second of two reports from Joe Shapiro, who covers this subject as deeply as anyone. And you can hear his previous report about a rash of accidental prescription drug overdoses at Army hospitals by going to NPR.org.
Now, what costs millions of dollars, 9 years, and almost one marriage? A little movie called Graduation. It opens today in 5 cities around the country.
Nobody is going to suspect us.
I spent 4 summers behind that counter. I know how it works. With my dad at graduation, the place is going to be running on a skeleton crew. We can be in and out in 10 minutes.
This heist movie has almost as many twists as the story behind its making. Graduation was written and lived by one of our colleagues here at All Things Considered, Corey Turner.
2 weeks before graduation, a high school senior discovers that her father, who runs the local bank, is having an affair. To get back at him, she convinces her 3 best friends to help her rob his bank. It's a heist, sure, but like all the best movie heists, it's about love, not the money. Screenwriting is kind of like pulling a heist. Instead of cracking a safe, you're trying to convince a Hollywood studio to finance a movie you probably hatched in the shower. My heist began in 1998. When I graduated from college and got into film school. I'd always dreamed of living in L.A. and writing movies. Rachel, my girlfriend, wanted us to go to D.C., where she'd always dreamed of working for a relief agency and seeing the world. My dream won. I wrote Graduation in film school and graduated with $40,000 in fresh green debt. That was in 2000. Soon, I landed the perfect day job reading gas meters, which freed up my afternoons to revise the script with my friend, Mike Mayer, who'd later direct the movie. But I'm getting ahead of myself. First came my marriage, in 2001, followed by tens of thousands of gas meters, and almost as many rejections from agents and managers who'd read early drafts of the script. "Come on," one agent wrote. "You've got to have sex by page 70. Finally. In 2003, we finished the script the way we wanted it and landed an agent who believed in it. She sent it all over town on a Wednesday, and that night, Rachel and I waited for the phone to ring and waited and waited. After a few hours, I turned on the TV and discovered that that night, the Iraq War had officially begun. Suddenly, people had far more important things to do than read my little heist. Soon, my agent stopped calling. By the winter of 2004, Rachel decided that she'd put off her own dream long enough. She found that relief job and made plans to start traveling. But she wanted me to go with her, which meant abandoning my failed script. And I just couldn't do it. Then, believe it or not, the phone finally rang. a producer of one of that year's Best Picture Oscar nominees, wanted to option Graduation. I met my lawyer at his favorite restaurant, A Little Taste of Hoboken, and he slid the check across the table. I called Citibank just to hear them say, "Yes, Mr. Turner, enough already. Your student loan has been paid in full." By August of 2005, I was in Pittsburgh for the start of the Graduation shoot. Rachel was in Kenya. Since then, we've both had our adventures, though mostly apart. Last year, we screened the finished movie for the cast and crew in L.A. Rachel had been in Sudan for months, and our marriage, honestly, was one awkward phone call away from disaster. And that's when it hit me. After 9 years, I'd actually gotten my movie made, but I wasn't happy. I'd become that idiot in every romantic comedy I hate who lands the girl of his dreams and then lets her get away. This past October, I finally said goodbye to L.A. Rachel and I moved to Washington, and tonight we'll be sitting in a darkened theater in Minneapolis, the closest city where we're opening, and together we're going to watch our movie. Now, I'm no Hollywood big shot, and I'm no richer than I was when I started, but like all the best movie heists, it's about love, not the money.
Corey Turner is an editor at All Things Considered. He lives with his wife, Rachel, in Washington, D.C. Graduation opens tonight in 5 cities around the country, and you can see clips from the movie and find reviews of other new films at npr.org/movies.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block. And Robert, this is a mini send-off for you today. You are heading off to Chengdu, China.
That's right. I'll be leaving tomorrow, first for Beijing and then flying from there to Chengdu, where we all will be at the end of May.
We'll be broadcasting All Things Considered from Chengdu from May 19th to May 23rd. Chengdu, the capital of Sichuan Province in western China.
Yeah, this is a part of the world where phenomenal changes are taking place, enormous economic growth, huge human migration within China, and of course, as the Chinese look forward to the Olympics, we're experiencing a season of openness for world media that we're going to take advantage of.
That's right, and Chengdu is a great place to talk about all of those things. Robert, it is also a great place to eat. It is, as we said, the capital of Sichuan Province.
I've heard of Sichuan food.
And the food is amazing and cheap. I should say, I was there in Chengdu last month doing some reporting for stories that will air later this month. And before I went, I talked to the cookbook writer Fuchsia Dunlop. She is an expert on Chinese food. It was the first Westerner to study cooking at the Sichuan Higher Institute of Cuisine, which is in Chengdu. This was back in the early 1990s. And Robert, she has written a food memoir of her years in China. The title is Shark's Fin and Sichuan Pepper. And listen to this. This is her description of Sichuan cuisine.
Sichuanese food, chuan cai, is the spice girl among Chinese cuisines, bold and lipsticked with a witty tongue and a thousand lively moods. Yi cai yi ge, bai cai bai wei. Each dish has its own style, they say, and 100 dishes have 100 different flavours. Sichuanese cooking doesn't require extravagant raw ingredients like Cantonese or Shandong. Yes, you can fashion a Sichuanese banquet out of such things if you must, but you can equally work wonders with the most humble ingredients, dazzle the taste buds with a simple repast of pork and aubergines. This is the greatness of Sichuanese cuisine, to make the ordinary extraordinary.
I'm getting hungry just listening to you, Fuchsia. You write about a lot of this extraordinary food that's quite ordinary that you would find back in the 90s in Chengdu, you would find on the street with vendors just selling stuff right off of their shoulders.
Yes, I used to hang around in very cheap and ordinary little restaurants and noodle shops, and the food that they served was so fresh and so delicious and so much more tasty than anything I'd had in Chinatown in London.
What was it about it that was so special?
Well, I think it was just, you know, the extraordinary layering of flavours in Sichuanese cuisine. So you get tastes mixed up together, sweet and sour and spicy. And then, of course, the sort of tingling, lip-numbing taste of Sichuan pepper. So a meal can be a really electrifying experience with so many different tastes.
Let's talk about the Sichuan pepper. This is key to Sichuan cuisine, as I read your book. And it's not what we would think of as a chili pepper at all.
No, it's completely unrelated to either pepper or the chili, and it's a really ancient Chinese spice. I mean, it is the original Chinese jiao, or pepper, in ancient times used as an aromatic and to ward off insects. And it's not actually hot spicy, but it sort of makes your lips numb and tingly. And the word for this sensation in Chinese is ma, which means pins and needles and anesthesia, which gives you some idea of what it's like.
And it's often, though, used in combination with dried red chilies that were imported, I guess, from Portugal. Is that right?
Yeah, they started being seen in China in the late Ming dynasty and spread towards Sichuan, I think, you know, 200 or 300 years ago. So they haven't been around for that long. But now chilies and Sichuan pepper are really the hallmark spices of Sichuanese cuisine, with that ma la, numbing and hot taste, which is kind of infamous in other parts of China.
You describe going for a hot pot supper out in the countryside, I think, and there's a wok filled with dried red chilies and all sorts of other things bubbling around. And as you eat your dinner, you describe your body running with sweat, and you end up feeling ragged and molten.
Yes. I mean, a hot pot in the sort of hot pot headquarters in Chongqing is the real numbing and hot experience. And you sit in front of a pot that seethes with chilies and Sichuan pepper. And every morsel of food that you cook in the wok and then take out to eat is kind of covered in bits of chili and Sichuan pepper. And it really, combined with the intense humidity of the Chongqing summer climate, is just, I mean, it's a real knockout. It's quite hilarious. It's so hot, you won't believe it.
And what do you do if, by chance, you don't have much of a taste for hot food? What if you're sort of a hot food wimp?
Well, Sichuanese food, although the international stereotype is that it's all fiendishly hot and spicy, is actually incredibly diverse. So I think there's something for every different kind of taste.
Including mine?
Including yours, no doubt.
You have this wonderful scene in the book where you describe a bean curd vendor who's selling fresh bean curd from his shoulder pole.
Yeah, I mean, the bean curd vendor selling flour bean curd or silken bean curd, which is very soft, almost like creme caramel. And the Sichuanese way is to serve it with chili and Sichuan pepper and soy sauce and vinegar and a few crunchy vegetables and nuts. And the vendors had these red and black wooden barrels, which they carried round on either end of a shoulder pole, and they just set them up here and there. And I used to spend a lot of time in tea houses reading and talking to people, and I would hear the douhua, calling out the name of this snack, and immediately sort of jump up and try and catch the vendor before he went. Yes, and this wonderful, the combination of the sort of very soft silkiness of the bean curd with the sort of crunchy fried soybeans and preserved mustard tuber and all these spicy tastes was just lovely.
So as I head off to Chengdu, Fuchsia, steer me in a direction of something that I really must taste there if I want to get the full Chengdu experience, the full Sichuanese experience.
Well, I would suggest that you go for gongbao chicken, the real authentic version of the dish known as kung po chicken in America, which has a sort of base flavor of scorched chilies and Sichuan pepper and a little sweet and sour. And also twice-cooked pork, which is one of the most beloved of all Sichuanese dishes, which is cooked pork, which is stir-fried very simply with chili bean paste and sweet fermented sauce and green garlic. And it's simple and cheap, and it's just fantastically tasty.
So these are both things I would find in any Chinese restaurant here in Washington, D.C. You're saying that it's going to taste completely different in Chengdu?
I think it'll probably be a revelation to you.
Fuchsia Dunlop, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's food writer Fuchsia Dunlop, and her book is Shark's Fin and Sichuan Pepper, A Sweet-Sour Memoir of Eating in China. Robert, you hungry?
I'm going to practice saying gung bao chicken.
Speaking of gung bao chicken, Robert, I took her up on her challenge, and the result of that will be in one of the stories airing later this month. I'll give you a hint. A white chef's hat is involved. And that will be during our week of broadcast, May 19th to 23rd from Chengdu. And there are recipes from Fuchsia Dunlop at npr.org.
Next time I see you, we'll be in China.
We'll see you in China.
Back now with Day to Day and She and Him.
I don't want you, but I need you.
She is actress Zooey Deschanel. Maybe you've seen her in the movie Elf or the TV show Weeds.
And the him in this duo is singer and songwriter M. Ward. The M is for Matt. He's worked with plenty of other female singers, Nora Jones, Cat Power, and Nico Case, just to name a few. But he's found a special chemistry, he says, with Zooey on their debut album called Volume 1. Day to Day's Alex Cohen spoke with them earlier this week before a performance at the Vista Theater in Los Angeles.
Zooey Deschanel has been acting in TV shows and films since she was a teenager, but she's been writing songs much longer than that. She wrote her first one when she was just 8 years old. It was about a fair.
Because that's kind of what you're interested in at the age of eight. It had sort of like a oompa kind of feel to it. I think it was called I'm Having Fun at the Fair. Yeah. It was very Meet Me in St. Louis-esque. Yeah.
Cool. Things have come a long way since I'm Having Fun at the Fair. Over the years, Deschanel has written and recorded a lot of songs. Songs where she sang harmonies with herself, played backup piano and guitar.
I'd be working here or there, and I would just every day go home and be writing songs and recording them. And it was sort of my way of relaxing. It was what I sort of enjoyed to do. The thing that I enjoyed doing most in my spare time.
In 2006, Deschanel and Ward were both cast in a film called The Go-Getter, and the director asked them to record a duet for the film's soundtrack, a cover of the Richard and Linda Thompson song, When I Get to the Border. When Deschanel and Ward started working on the song in the studio, something clicked.
I knew Zooey's music from Elf, and I loved the voice. I thought that there was maybe a Zooey Deschanel record. There wasn't.
Then Ward discovered there were all those demo tapes she'd been recording. He asked to listen to some of them. Deschanel says that request was mildly terrifying.
It's so personal. It's a very personal experience writing music. It's like you hear something and you think I like it, but then it's hard sometimes the first time you say, like, I wrote this, do you think it's okay? You know, I mean, that's very scary.
So she started safe. She sent him a recording of something she hadn't written.
Swim low, sweet chariot, come for carry me home.
He liked it. So she sent him some of her own compositions.
I was taking a walk, when I saw you pass by.
I just loved the songs, and it's really rare that you find good songs. It's as simple as that.
When I saw you smile, I saw a dream come true.
And the vocal arrangements were, if I could do that on my four-track tapes, I would have done it a long time ago.
Ward persuaded Deschanel to record an album, which they simply titled Volume 1, and they formed a band. Even though their names both have star power, they decided to pick a moniker with just two simple pronouns, she and him.
We both talked about liking the idea of a name that's sort of anonymous and sort of humble. I always like the name The Band because it's not about being like the star of anything. It's about the music.
The music of She and Him is reminiscent of artists like Linda Ronstadt, the Beach Boys, the Ronettes, music that Zooey and Matt listened to as kids on the radio. They also recorded a few covers, including this tribute to the Fab Four.
I should have known better with a guy like you that I would love everything.
where many artists rely on synthesizers, computer sampling, and vocal processing, she and him definitely take the low-tech approach. For instance, on this track called This Is Not a Test, Deschanel uses her mouth as a trumpet of sorts.
I just like music that sounds like music and that people are making the music, not like machines and computers and, you know, things that you design to make things sound slick and perfect.
She and him have been playing concerts in Austin, Texas, New York, and here in L.A. And though Zooey Deschanel is plenty used to performing, she says going on tour has been a bit different.
As an actor, I'm doing something somebody else wrote, and I'm just sort of interpreting that. It's similar with performing songs, but having written them, it's sort of... It's nice because I'm so familiar with the details of the particular emotions I was trying to express.
Take it back, take it back. I don't want your loving anymore.
They've sold out everywhere they've played, but Deschanel isn't giving up her day job acting anytime soon. She was recently heard as a voice on the TV show The Simpsons and has several films coming out this year, including the one she and M. Ward met on.
I put a spell on you.
Zooey Deschanel and M. Ward say they have plans to put out a follow-up record to Volume 1. The duo isn't quite sure what they'll call it. Maybe...
Volume 2. Might be.
It's too early
we
to
like
say.
That name.
Volume 2 has got a nice ring to it.
It's got a great ring to it.
She and him will perform next at the Oyster Festival in San Francisco later this month. Alex Cohen, NPR News.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brandon. Alex, have you been to this big shopping center here in Los Angeles called The Grove?
You know, I have heard about it. I have heard that it's some kind of experiential thing. Mm-hmm. But no, I haven't actually been there.
Well, it's what urban planners call a mediated community space.
Well, any community space in Los Angeles would be a good thing.
Right, exactly. People are in their cars a lot. But this mediated community space, what it means is that the developer wanted to create more than just a traditional shopping mall, but a place for people to come and hang out. And so he created this sort of fake village. It's kind of a fake Italian village. It's got like cobblestone streets, a trolley car, a dancing fountain, a village green.
It's got kind of like a theme. It's like a shopping theme park.
So yeah, exactly. And some 25 million people come to the Grove every year. They spend a lot of money, twice as much, in fact, as shoppers at traditional malls do. In fact, this model has been so successful that the developer of it is unveiling a brand new sort of a super Grove today.
Oh, boy, more shopping opportunities in Los Angeles. So where is this place and what is it?
Well, it's twice as big as the Grove. And get this, you can not only shop there and hang out there, you can actually live there.
Well, it's good for people who really do live to shop.
Yeah, and there will be swimming pools and gyms. It's sort of like a resort hotel, shops below. It's actually called the Americana. And Alex, I went out there a couple of days ago. You know, workers were busily scrubbing everything, rushing to get everything finished. I went out there to meet the guy behind the Americana to basically see what his vision is of the future, a vision that is rooted in the past.
Okay, let's go.
Step inside the Americana development, and you know, you really are stepping away from reality. How do I know that? Well, staring right at me as I enter is a gigantic chandelier. I'm not kidding, a 12-foot tall chandelier dangling outside over the main street. And underneath that chandelier, dozens and dozens and dozens of workers busily scrubbing, laying cement, doing last-minute fixes for the grand opening of the Americana this week. It's like a movie set. It's like Disneyland. It's a little like Las Vegas. In other words, it has this feeling that it's not real, but actually, it is real. People are going to live here. People are going to shop here. They're going to live their lives in this place that was entirely created by one man, a man who has a vision of another kind of America. His name is Rick Caruso.
All right.
Fantastic.
Okay,
well, thank
we
you
made
very
it.
Much.
Thank
yes,
you again.
Good to meet
okay.
you.
Good meeting
so,
you.
So,
Tell me, where are we right now? What are we looking at?
We are in the green, which is a 2-acre park, and it has mature trees and flowers and a signature fountain that dances with the music, and some beautiful artwork, and surrounded by the residential and retail components of the project.
What is your mission, if you could describe it as a mission or your vision? Why not create just a regular old mall with high-end retail stores? Why did you want to create an entire community?
Yeah, I get excited when I travel and you see these spots where just people are out. There's a sense of life to them. And it's not about creating a shopping center. I think for the most part, we're not in the shopping center business. You know, we're in the place creation business. And the shopping is ancillary to people being here, and the restaurants are part of people being here, but that's not what drives us. Because as you said, if that was our mission, we would be building traditional stores and just lining them up and fill them up. But that's not what we're passionate about doing.
But the lure here for people who aren't going to buy the condos or live in the apartments, well, the lure, right, or it's the Armani Exchange, the
sure.
Barney's Co-op I'm looking at, the Cheesecake Factory, and these are all shops, retail outlets.
Yeah, and no question, but I think the lure is also, there's multiple lures. The lure is also people just coming out and throwing a blanket down and being in the park. And that's, to me, what's the most interesting and fascinating is when we open on Friday, see it come to life. You know, because right now it's ours, and Friday morning we have to give it up. And it's a magical thing when it gets populated with families and friends and everybody hanging out.
Now, some critics would say about this project and The Grove and maybe your other projects that it's manufactured, that it's ersatz, that it's cheesy in a way. How do you answer those criticisms that you are manufacturing a sense of place that resides on a sense of sentimentality, of a past and nostalgia that didn't never really existed?
Yeah. You know, I give it actually no thought because people vote on their feet. It's packed. It's crowded. People love it. You can criticize it and say, based on the books, you shouldn't do this. I don't know what book that would be, but, you know, the people that I've come across that are critical of it have never done anything other than study urban planning and never done any urban planning. But, you know, we do what we think is right, and thank God the people have voted in favor of it. And they're there, and they use it and enjoy it, and it's very successful.
This is a $400 million project.
Right.
Are you worried at all? We are in the midst of a recession, by most counts. Mm-hmm. People, they're just not spending as much as they used to on retail.
Right.
Are you worried that this is going up at the wrong time?
No, because I'm not a market timer, and I don't think anybody can be. And, you know, I equate it to building a plane. You don't build a plane for fair weather. You have to build a plane to deal with turbulence. I think quality always does well. I think people gravitate to quality. And over the next 30 years of this project, there's going to be cycles. And can you imagine building something or investing in anything just for good times? You know, you'd quickly be broke. So I'm not worried about it at all.
So is this the future?
I think it's the best of all worlds. You get the urban experience when you want it, and you get the resort experience at your fingertips. Who wouldn't want that?
You don't have to step over homeless people to get to your front door.
I didn't say that. I'm politically correct.
Rick Caruso, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed being with you. Okay. All right. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Madeline, tell me about this guy, Rick Caruso.
You mean what he looked like
and
what he was like? Well, he's in his late 40s, and he's really, really tan, really fit-looking. He was wearing some really expensive, probably Italian handmade shoes and a white shirt that, I don't know, it had like maybe 1,000 thread count or something.
So this man is doing all right.
Yeah, he is doing all right. He just exudes doing all right. His company has lots of other projects, more than $1 billion worth of developments there that are in the works. And that's just here in Southern California. And Rick Caruso says he is planning on taking his idea, this idea of mediated community space, to other areas of the country.
Be on the lookout, dear listeners. Day to Day continues.